Hello, and welcome to the Sydney Screen Studies Network Talks, a series of talks by scholars and graduate students on all aspects of film, television, and screen-based media. If you'd like to join our network or find out more about us, you can follow us on Twitter at @SSSnetwork and like us on Facebook at Sydney Screen Studies. You can also visit our website at sydneyscreenstudies.wordpress.com.
Cool. Thanks so much, Phoebe, and thanks to the SSN for having me. This is actually pretty cool. You'll see pretty quickly I'm not a visual cultures person necessarily. I am from the English department, so that's probably not overly surprising. So there are plenty of holes that I hope you guys can point out for me in any and all of the things I'm about to rant at you. I did want to echo the acknowledgement of country as well. And I have to start with trigger warning. There's going to be violence here. I'm talking about FPSs, so that's kind of goes with the territory. There's also going to be talk of terrorism, particularly American terrorism, and pornography as well. So, yeah, just so you're aware. All right, so let's kick this off then. Death is merely a temporary irritation. I'm the resurrection and the life. I've lived 1,000 lives and taken thousands more. But what am I? In an era of indeterminacy, the very notion of the self finds itself under increasing scrutiny, encapsulated perhaps surprisingly, not least in the medium of the video game. Subject and object blur, binaries break down utterly as the dichotomies of self and other cease to maintain any significance. Character, avatar, ego, persona, all indecipherable and interchangeable. I am legion, I am the subject and the object, the player and the played. Neither wholly narrative nor wholly interactive. Video games operate in a liminal space that's proven fairly difficult to conceptualize. Film and literature only represent at most partial and incomplete comparisons for this field, this new burgeoning cultural field, which actually has, since the turn of the millennia, significantly outsold its predecessors. Video games can be seen in a positive light to represent a rather radical discursive change in Western storytelling and embody the beginning of a reformation of the narrative subjects. Or perhaps more soberly, and not necessarily exclusively, video games function for a mere repurposing of the narrative subject. The game plays the player, with its pseudo-interactivity merely reinforcing the self-replicating state of consumer capitalism. Consume, conform, repeat. And so this paper is going to begin the task of assessing the very problem of the self, grounded in a brief case study of this really shitty video game Crysis 2 from 2010 and Peter Watt's subsequent novelization of the game Crysis Legion from the following year. For a grammatical deconstruction of the text, this paper's going to attempt to contrast the visual grammar of the game with the textual grammar of the novel, particularly in their respective regulations of point of view, to demonstrate the interdependence of discursive form and semantic significance. Both of these science fictional texts are structured around a fight to retain New York in an alien invasion and are foreign refractions of the myth of American superiority. Now, despite the common content, the discursive differences in the two texts elucidate the fractious relationship between perception, ideology, and entertainment, demonstrating that, as political scientist James Derrian inimitably phrases it, questions of violence are always already questions of identity. Crysis 2, as I've intimated, is a largely interchangeable example of the so-called first-person shooter, an FPS. It's formulaic, it's uninspiring, and it's ideologically suspect, to say the very least. To think of FPS titles as a form of marine training simulators is probably not that far removed from reality. Many of the most successful franchises have been appropriated by the military for recruitment and training purposes. Perhaps the kindest thing that can be said about Crysis 2, and by extension its genre in general, is that it's merely another entry in a very long line of cliched military hero fantasies. The standard viewpoint that you can see here of the FPS is designed to conjure the illusion of unmediated access to the game environment. the players inhabiting the perspective of their avatar, with hands and weaponry being the only corporeal elements visible on screen. The formula of these titles generally has them retain this tightly regulated point of view, the singular perspective and limited cast of characters, championing the role of the individual in modern warfare. Accordingly, FPS games will typically remain somewhat paranoid of hierarchical decision-making, otherwise there's simply no place to be a hero. Whilst the motives of the powers that be may be questioned within a strictly circumscribed area, the overwhelming majority nonetheless retain an overt love affair with violence. I mean, surprising no one, they're called shooters after all. Violence in the vast majority of these titles is portrayed as a legitimate tool of coercive power for hegemonic military forces to use at will. But even the minority of titles which are somewhat critical of the material they're reproducing nonetheless reproduce it. American literary and cultural theorist John Carlos Rowe once observed that combat films with radically different political perspectives often contribute equally to pro-military sentiments. And the sheer spectacular interactivity of the violent content in these kinds of video games mark them as potentially a troubling new media iteration of the same impulse. Cultural theorist Paul Virilio's observations about the interrelationship between ocular technologies and the changing nature of warfare take on peculiar new resonance in the digital era. The fusion's complete, the confusion is perfect, etc. Indeed, there's actually a fitting confluence as war drives the creation of sophisticated technology. Technology now actively contributes to the militarization of the individual. Now, this is something we're going to see played out to full effect over the course of this paper and certainly through this game and most games like it, really. Now, many of the promotional clips which preceded the official release of Crysis 2 were aesthetically spectacular, but exegetically vacuous. Their arresting inanity revealing the seemingly irreconcilable tension between spectacle and exposition that defines most action forms. So I'll give you a... Right, so you can see how ridiculous it is. 10 points if you can tell me anything about the narrative from that. Another 10 points if you can guess the composer of the score as well. Anyway, we'll come back to that potentially. Yeah, he's a big name. A big name. Yes. So you've seen it. Though filmic in nature, some of that was reproduction of gameplay and some of it was pre-rendered digital film. The repetitive invocation of the B, insert action noun here, that comprised much of the marketing of the game, you didn't see it in that clip, but you'll see it in one I'm going to play shortly, is rather telling, I'd say. Even within the epitextual material, there's a concerted attempt to have the spectator morph into participant and occupy the positions of witness and perpetrator simultaneously. This interstice is precisely where my personal interest lies with the gaming medium, the slippery division between spectatorship and complicity. Video games are frequently opined to be interactive, I've been saying that myself here, as opposed to the static artistic productions of the past, but I think that's probably a too simplistic a way to look at it. Part of the problem, I think, simply comes from a lack of clarity and consistency of terms that are commonly applied to the medium, each of which holds increasingly esoteric and divergent meanings in different disciplines. We simply lack a common language, I think, to talk or to reach a standard set of conceptions about video games. Take the descriptor first-person shooter, for instance. What does the first person refer to? How does this relate to the grammatical person of linguistics in written or spoken language, or indeed the first person of cinematic point of view, both of which are already incommensurate with one another? The common theme I'd suggest of these uses of first person is an inflection of perspective. Each describes the relationship between parties privy to a narrational or a speech act. Implicit in this figurative communicative milieu is the binary of sender and receiver. These roles must be filled, even if it's by the same entity, for communication to be realised. In the English language, the case of person is governed in large part by grammatical facets of inflectional morphology. So this is the English guy in me. If anything's unclear, just stop me and I'll clear it up. If this gets too jargon heavy as well, just stop me. Throw something at me. But anyway, inflectional morphology essentially involves the modulation of word forms. So we're talking about things like number, so plural, putting an S on something is an example. Things like tense, which I'll be talking about now, a little bit later actually, and person, which I'll be talking about now. Yes. So grammatical person, where I want to start, is a category used in the classification of certain types of words to distinguish between different parties involved in a speech act. The speaker, the addressee, or a third party. In short, they're kind of a method of, positioning the narrator in a particular speech act or within a given text, more to the point. So, for example, a first-person narrator speaks from an individual perspective. So, for example, I bored everyone to sleep with my talk. A second-person narrator speaks on behalf of the receiver. You all roll your eyes at Ben's pointless ranting. And a third-person narrator speaks from an exterior perspective. He could think only of having some more wine shortly. This simple function actually seems to propose rather profound problems, I find, in the transition from verbal to visual. Both cinema and video games seem unable to wholly align with the perspectival grammatical aspects that permeate all natural languages, not just English. So to return to the question of the first person that I raised, traditional first person narration fosters a communicative pathway from narrator to addressee. There's a transactional exchange of information or narrative. But there's never any question that a first person narrator is separate from their audience. Broadcaster and receiver exist as two independent parties. Now, this is self-evidently not the case in what we've just seen. The seeing through another's eyes imagery that you have over there seems to actually, well, it's certainly not equivalent to first person narration. It seems to actually be a bastardization of first and second person narration in a weird kind of way. I haven't quite wrapped my head around how it kind of functions. But anyway, Crisis 2, the game, constructs the protagonist, that weird looking dude there, as an identifiable character. His name is Alcatraz. And that will come back. I can hear by the laughter you can already see that has some meaning. But the character is also an avatar, of course, a digital icon whose actions are subordinate to direct player input. John Farrow, his ambitious recent work on fictional character, I think, is fairly useful here. He talks about, the actual quote is, "Fictional character is textually constructed in the play between positions of enunciation and figural constructs in the game world, and these positions are cumulatively and complexly filled during the course of a prose narrative or a lyric or a film or gameplay." And I think that's a really interesting conflation of all those different mediums. But moving away from that, I think the point I want to draw out here is it's the interactivity of the game that directly denies the player any clear separation of character and avatar. Replete with his own history and psychology, Alcatraz's subordination to player control implicates both him and the player in the actions that he's shown to undertake. So the player character, the point of all this, the player character is both subject and object. And this leads media theorists Dean Lockwood and Tony Richards to suggest a collapse of the ability of the player to negotiate the complexity of the form. They say that by giving power to the gamer in the form of controls, by immersing the sensory motor engagement of the player into the game space, the player becomes the first person subject of the space. This paradoxically robs the player of conscious awareness or critical distance. They are fashioning their own text as they render themselves powerless. I think that's just a fascinating point they're drawing out there. But as avatar and character are forced into this kind of unstable alliance, there's a tension, certainly, and I think a confusion between stative and dynamic verbal forms as they relate to narrative perspective. So stative is "I am Alcatraz," dynamic is "I play Alcatraz," and there's a definite difference between those two. Now, what I'm saying is that spectator complicity is constructed through the visual grammar of the interactive medium. a structured codification of language that performs a kind of self-effacement and a self-estrangement, I'd argue. Even in this that I've got looping behind me here, the choreography of angular and camera shifts accords with a transition between all three narrational perspectives. Responsibility for the repetitive and ultimately mundane destruction is constantly deferred. That's this breakdown of critical distance that I think is the most significant thing to point out. In concert with the grammatical category of person, another aspect of inflectional morphology intensifies this breakdown, and that's tense, as I intimated before. The game thrives on its immediacy, and as such exists in a continuous present tense. The events can't have taken point at a prior point of time, otherwise the personal possessive element makes no sense. The violent orgy occurs at a frenzied pace, which discourages critical reflection, as noted, and thus conceals the ultimate locus of accountability. So that's the quote you've got on the screen there that I find myself in some worrying agreement with, actually. The consistent spectacle is one of Alcatraz engaging in indiscriminate massacre. On a pragmatic level, the massacre of these human security forces that you're seeing play out here basically occurs because generic adherence requires the game to get more difficult. So the humans are kind of a training ground for the aliens that pop up later. The fact that Crysis 2 is such a standardized FPS by numbers, stripped of all ambition, gunning for the lowest common denominator is exactly the problem with it, and with most of these titles. The moral cartography of these games is entirely egocentric. The self is always in the right. The positively identified enemy is always worthy of extermination. Now, I'd suggest that this perhaps drives the strangely recursive cinema envy that you see permeating video games, and particularly the FPS genre. And this title's terribly bad at it. It's almost desperate in its attempt to be a film. The director fashions himself as an auteur, which you'll see a little bit later as well. But it's like it's screaming for, it's like, please like me. I'm good. I'm worth doing. I'm worth talking about. I'm worth playing. But yeah, as I say, video games do frequently remediate filmic form. And certainly in titles such as this, it's rather heavy-handed. But even in stuff that tries to get away from filmic form, you have kind of non-interactive cutscenes, they're called, which imitate the form of the theatrical space to intimate that this is a non-interactive space you're entering. But I'd argue that both mediums, cinema and video game, that is, have entirely different methods of creating narrative. With echoes of Marshall McLuhan, digital artist Simon Penny goes so far as to assert that the procedural nature of interactive imagery means that content is as much in the routine that runs the image as it is in the image itself. And I think there's certainly a lot of truth to this. Games are a medium which is centered around emergent narrative. The narrative is, within rigid boundaries admittedly, always in a state of quantum indeterminacy. And I've gone too far, haven't I? Or have I not gone far enough? There you go. Sorry. Yeah, so death is immaterial and immutable, and immutable narrative trajectories are anathema. Games represent the art of simulation, the hermeneutic other of narratives, the alternative mode of discourse in game theorist Espen Aarseth's typically provocative terms. But whilst it is true that games are at the mercy of user inputs, it's also the case that user inputs are mediated through a graphical user interface. The actual language of the game, its code, is hidden under a gloss of aesthetic simulacra. In the digital sphere, coding and graphical interfaces replace the photographic image. Digital images are not a reproduction of the real, they're a reproduction of a reproduction of the real. This is kind of Baudrillard's simulacra come to full spectacular fruition. I was hoping for some laughs with that, but there you go, there they are. Pity laughter's good. So thus, even a mediocre game, well, actually a shitty game, like Crysis 2, despite its overt falsity, still retains a kind of spectral force, what Lockwood and Richards refer to as a hauntology, in which the powerful combination of immersivity and interactivity extend the power of cinema to interpolate the user. Now, their recourse to Althusserian theory, interpolation there, is described as a process by which ideology, both public and private, constitutes its subjects, is, I think, apt. The commercial FPS, by its nature, is designed as an immersion machine, which attempts to effect a breakdown in the critical apparatus of the player. They're just too fucking stupid. Questioning's replaced by action. John Farrell asserts that the mode of being an avatar is bound up with the ends it serves. And he actually goes on to strongly imply a link between gaming and pornography, which he sees as an extreme but not atypical form of the effective working of texts, being marked by a poverty of its characterization. And clearly that kind of works, I think. Pornography, in fact, proves to be a rather useful touchstone, and not only because both pornography and video games involve twiddling joysticks and pressing buttons. Pornography is so effective not because we are thinking about sex, but because we think we are having sex. There's no difference between arousal and the thought of arousal. Pornography then actually offers us an unusually pure form in which to observe how empathy functions. Now stay with me. As it turns out, we as a species are neurologically wired with an inbuilt pornographic impulse, the mirror neuron system. The strangeness of these mirror neurons lies in the fact that they become activated both when an action is performed and when an action is observed. So when we have intercourse, say, these mirror neurons spark. If we watch someone else in coitus, the very same neurons are firing, despite our own lack of fornication. Now, for the brain, spectatorship and performance are one and the same, which is probably why I'm so disturbed by FPSs in general. So these neurons are widespread in our brains, and as I've intimated, they're theorized to be essential for developing empathy and for imitative learning, which is probably more to the point, amongst a whole bunch of other functions. So I'd suggest then Farrow has it the wrong way around. Rather than pornography representing an outlying extremity of effect, it's actually affect in its purest unmediated form. The very notion of character is a mediation of the pornographic impulse, I want to say. All art, at base, is pornography interrupted. The real moral issue with pornography and the kind of video games I'm talking about tonight is their direct stimulation of our neurological hotspots, which are entirely divorced from any semblance of rational conscious mediation. This is empathy in its purely self-centered form. Rather than seeing others as intentional agent objects in their own right, there's an imposition of the self on the other. The holy grail of total immersion, as Simon Penny contends, is ultimately either psychotic or hallucinogenic. The medium, I'd suggest, is indeed the message. By contracting the allowable space for critical reflection in the user, the dubious morality of the standard FPS amplifies in propagandistic value. The launch trailer for Crysis 2, then, takes on additional significance. And here it is. Okay, apologies to everyone's ears for that. Apart from the stunning aesthetic, though, it was played for a point. Apart from the stunning aesthetic, the one thing that can't be escaped is the horrendously bombastic musical reworking of New York, New York, as performed by American rapper B.O.B., I don't know what that stands for, I don't really care, and Alicia Keys was the female singer there. The rhetorical structure of the lyric, I want to argue here, is of central import, with the consistent rap variants of these American fights, these American wars, blah, 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 in clear contrast with the sung choral refrain of New York, New York. Now, whilst the montage imagery engages in a spectacle of violence and bloodshed, the musical cues function to center the geographical location as of central significance. Now, the musical partitioning, I want to argue, mirrors New York's occupation of a kind of grey space in the global psyche, representing both the centre of global wealth and the gateway to the land of opportunity. New York's entire existence has had a markedly symbolic character. It's the place in which the abstract has become embodied, a place in which the brash rhetoric of the American dream materializes in monuments of incredible bombast. Ultimately, though, economics rules. New York City is also the synecdochical core of American financial dominance, and predominantly the scene of extreme excess, not least Trump himself. New York is simultaneously one of the most sanctified representatives of a cashed-up global America, and also one of the most segregated and vilified. So New York exists in a psychologically liminal grey space between the best and the worst of America, I think. It's this symbolism, I want to argue, that ensures New York City is frequently the incipient victim of spectacular destruction in fiction. And the aestheticized violence inflicted upon the long-suffering city is something that was, of course, ultimately manifested in the 9/11 attacks. The sheer volume of destruction that's been wrought upon New York suggests that this literalization of the symbolic American immigrant dream has been almost too successful. It's not merely the aesthetic that's the target of the devastation, but the symbolism that underlies the aesthetic. Now, prior to 9/11, New York's representative emblematic structure was, of course, the Statue of Liberty. With Emma Lazarus's idyllic and, I think, touching tributary sonnet still being at least partially recognisable to most of us in the Western world, certainly to me. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless tempest tossed to me. I lift my golden lamp beside, I lift my lamp even, beside the golden door. Many of us, I'd hazard to guess, perhaps I'm wrong, I would hazard to guess, still see these lines as a message of hope springing eternal. The sentiment is genuinely idealistic and utopian. But I wonder how many of us remember its poetic surrounds. I'd like to draw attention to the preceding line and a half. Keep ancient land your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. These welcoming remarks, then, it's largely forgotten, remain unspoken. These poetic lines are a textual ekphrasis of a proposed symbolic underpinning. A prosopopoeia spoken by the voiceless figure of the statue herself. Now, these kinds of unspoken, sweeping proclamations seem to comprise the fabric of American history, I think, functioning rhetorically rather than literally. As an embodied spectacle, the lady's silence has ensured her symbolic existence is indeed spectral, as she finds herself appropriated to reinforce the increasing insularity of the American zeitgeist. Her destruction in countless fictional texts is generally presented as symbolically akin to the death of liberty, but I think this is rather missing the point. The irony is surely obvious in a post-Trump world. America's now become a land reveling in its own mythologies, full of sound and fury, signifying virtually nothing. Lady Liberty's evisceration merely makes manifest the disemboweling of the symbolic greatness of her represented nation-state, and should be more fully understood as a rescinding of the welcome of the other. Perhaps the mother of exiles would have been better served by holding a submachine gun or building a wall. However, given millennial events and the time in which this game was conceived, written and released, so remember this was released in 2010, the emphasis has irreversibly shifted, with the most infamous symbol of New York then and now, symbolically and ironically, an absence. Accordingly, I'd suggest there's something more at stake in the use of the alien invasion. The aliens in this story stand in as allegories for their etymological precursors, foreigners. The repetitive montage of wholesale slaughter uses alien and human fodder interchangeably. The mise-en-scene is structured so they are quite literally equivalent here. There is, on a formal and narrative level, no difference between the human and the non-human as subjects of or objects of violent action. We know that similar alignments of segments of humanity with the metaphorical other have a long history within and without fiction. What's so interesting about this particular instantiation of the other in the form of the alien invasion that permeates so many of these FPS titles is that most invocations of the trope, including this one, of course, seem remarkably oblivious to its imperialist and racist ideological underpinnings. So, Crisis 2 is actually recycling national narratives in a manner which both flattens and conflates them. It's the very real destruction of the Twin Towers, as symbols of the capitalist authority of America and the West, that's come to haunt the fictional destruction of the Statue of Liberty. James Dedarian suggests that, like an autoimmune response, 9/11 triggered a virtuous war in which images clearly dominated words. Now, it is indeed something that Crisis 2 is aware of on some level, with direct replication of 9/11 imagery in various promotional clips. So here we go again. The game could have been good. It would have worked wonderfully as a horror game. Anyway, it's just such a shame. Yeah, so it seems inarguable then that Crisis 2 is a visual and virtual response to 9/11. The text conflation of America's large-scale immigration history with the 9/11 attacks is actually an act of motivated forgetting. Now, that phrase comes courtesy of late political scientist Michael Rogan, who once traced the connection between... What did he trace the connection between? American politics and public spectacle as follows. In this motivated forgetting, that which is insistently represented becomes, by being normalised to invisibility, absent and disappeared. Now, as we've observed, the linking of 9/11 imagery and fictionalised destruction of the Statue of Liberty actually results in a motivated forgetting of actual history, to be replaced with a spectacular simulacrum of reality in which Western imperialism locates itself in a vacuum of victimhood, or as Baudrillard, in his own inimitable way, would have it, an ideal reverse of fortune for a nation at last wounded at its heart and free, having atoned for it to exert its power in all good conscience. Interesting that he talks about science fiction there as well. The fact that Crisis 2 was produced by a German company with a creative team that featured mainly non-Americans is actually rather symptomatic of the continuing resonance of 9/11 for the entirety of the West, I'd say. From the outset, then, the subsequent novelization of the game, Crisis Legion, and this is where I get excited because this is great, takes a decidedly more critical approach. The copyright page features the following disclaimer. I'll let you guys read that. I'll just stop talking for a second. I heard a few chuckles. The irony's palpable, right? Video games are supposedly more mutable than literature, and yet here we encounter an explicit statement that the novelization displays variation from gameplay. Yearly's comment, I believe, shows perhaps one or both of these things, but either a fundamental misunderstanding of the nature of the video game medium. Like I said before, he kind of sets himself up as this auteur. Look at me and what I can do. It's just ridiculous. Or a reactionary distancing from the novel's interrogation of the ridiculous and problematic tropes of gaming ideology and narrative present in Crisis. The novel's approach, on the other hand, is defined by a ruthless analytical rigour, and despite recounting the same plot, reformulates its discursive structure to violently disrupt the very generic tropes it utilises. The novel stands as a brutal critique, but not through any specific corruption of its hypertext. Rather, through temporal and perspectival consolidation, the novel makes explicit what's been implicit in the game all along, existing as an unflinching exposure of the game's disturbing doctrinal unconscious. Through structural alteration alone, the adaptation actually undermines the entirety of the franchise, and it's a glory to read. We can perceive that shifted perspectival and temporal approach in Crisis Legion, the adaptation has a complex heteroglossic or many-vocaled, many-voiced narrative form. A fictional editor's note opens the text proper, explaining the polyphonic nature of its composition as a found text compilation. And there is about the first half a paragraph there reproduced. You don't have to bother reading it. The significance of this editorial positioning should be evident from the opening verbal inflections. It's in the past tense, meaning that the events are located in the past. Yeah? The novel is a completed narrative rather than the narrative of the game, which is continuously unfolding in the present. Now, this shift tense proves to have interesting ramifications. The most dominant mode of the text is actually a monological dialogue, and I know that's a contradiction in terms. I can talk about it in question time if you want. Of Alcatraz in a debriefing session. I'll read that out. Why not? How am I doing for time? I remember running across my first mop-up, containment, whatever word they used to whitewash the whole massacre thing. What? I don't give a flying fuck if they're infected. They were civilians. Yeah, that's how they always justify it, isn't it? Quarantine, protecting the population, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. All that shit. Let me tell you, these assholes were not racked by remorse over the necessary evil they were committing. They were laughing. They were using those poor bastards for target practice. The present tense in this narration is contemporaneous with the speech act itself. Alcatraz, as first-person narrator, the I here, is recalling past events. Again, we're seeing a sharp division between the game's progressive present tense and the novel's perfective past. But a closer examination of the tense elements of just this passage alone proves revealing, as we observe actually a tense construction in aspectual flux. The passage opens with a simple present denotation of reflection, so the remember, with the majority of the verbal forms underlined here, adhering to present tense arrangement. But where things get really interesting is in the final few lines, where the tense transitions from the simple present earlier noted to a progressive past form. So the were committing, were laughing, were using. The transition then's a conflation of past and present. The dislocation and confusion of temporality mirroring the undead past of psychological trauma. Alcatraz's recollection of these borderline war crimes is viscerally experienced through his grammatical usage. And this traumatic recount of violence provides an insight into Alcatraz's purported reasons for his own murderous rampage. The grammar of the novel then provides an interstice in which irony can function. The complicity between avatar and character appears to break down between the mediums. But actually not quite. In fact, Crisis Legion is closer to a sequel than a straight adaptation. Why, after all, is Alcatraz suffering from PTSD? Because we, as players, have done this to him. Alcatraz seems on some level aware of this as he shows confusion as to his own identity. I look down at myself. There I am. I am into it. Viewing himself as both grammatical subject and object in the opening sentence, the I look down at myself, I and myself, subject, object, we see a kind of self-alienation at play, I want to argue. And psychiatrist Lawrence J. Kermayer argues that the intrusions of traumatic memory can make the self alien until the quotidian self can be reasserted only by isolating the unbearable feeling. And this one-man killing rampage, rather than simply being retributive justice for remembered war crimes, is a kind of displaced rage against the lack of control available to the self, I'm going to say. The stutter down the end, the I am, speaks volumes. After self-identifying as deaf incarnate, which he does all throughout the passage, we see Alcatraz is only able to refer to his existential being through a prepositional phrase that relates him to continuing slaughter. Now, the story establishes Alcatraz's super soldier attributes as a result of a symbiosis between his human military discipline form and what's essentially a living or a semi-organic suit of armor. That's why he looks so weird in those... Well, you can kind of see him in the background there. Alcatraz's codename and his relationship to the suit become increasingly fitting as the narrative progresses. And we eventually discover that the suit has been drawing its power by literally eating him alive. The belated narration of the novel allows for extensive ruminations on the incorporation of the human into the post-human, I think, here, particularly in this passage. The central element to which I want to draw attention is the increasing grammatical complication of the passage, moving from a very basic intransitive clause, my head clears, to the complexity of the final bracketed sentences, replete with multiple objects, coordinated clauses, and various shifts between verbal inflections. The passage then, through grammatical change, replicates the change that's occurring at a narrative level. imitating the increasingly complex transition from the human to the post-human. But there's also something incredibly meta about this, like in light of what I was talking about with the division between character and avatar, right? Like this is a comment on video games themselves as well. Alcatraz as an individual entity is being eroded from multiple directions, devoured from the inside in the narrative, overcome by an unprecedented syntactical and grammatical prowess in the novel, and controlled and stripped of agency from the outside by the player of the game. I'm wrapping up now. Facile texts such as Crisis 2 can and should be interrogated, as their very stupidity can illuminate and proliferate the dangerous inadequacies of society at large. Popular cultural artistic mediums, with their overwhelming social prevalence and consumption, need to be treated seriously and approached critically. I find myself in accordance with Roger Stahl's suggestion that there are many ways of killing that do not necessarily involve pulling the trigger oneself, such as the collective condoning of violence. And I think that's exactly what the FPS genre does. The content of popular texts can be marshaled to reach a more productive understanding of the inescapable violence upon which society and its structuring systems are built. With recognition that the mimetic mix of image and violence has been proven to be more powerful than rational discourse, the vacuity of the crisis can no longer be deferred, and is perhaps more spectacular than it at first appears. But even rational discourse, with all my talk of rationality and how stupid video games are, is overrated. Any consideration of art and the language and grammar on which it relies must negotiate the gulf between the arbitrary nature of language and the real cultural outcomes of art. The entirety of human epistemology, after all, is based on a similarly violent slippage. Natural language both defines and is defined by us. Language indeed is oppositional, a blunt instrument to bludgeon and synthesize difference into a communicable form. And natural language even is, without exaggeration, the defining characteristic of us as a species. Our communicative existence underlies the organization of the entire social strata and, as I've noted, is responsible for our entire epistemological frame. It's the ubiquity of language, I want to suggest, that marks its oddity. Because we all use it, we don't realize how fucking weird it is. The meaning arising from language, of course, is completely arbitrary. That's why we have multiple languages. It's kind of defined by what R.L. Trask, a linguist, calls a duality of patterning. The use of a small number of meaningless elements in combination to produce a large number of meaningful elements. Evidently, though, if the smallest components are arbitrary, the larger units must be arbitrary as well. The referential tension of minute elements is fractal. The linguistic system is identically unmotivated at every level of observable existence. Language has no truth value at all. It's a medium for communication that, as I've noted, is oppositional in design and function. As a representational medium responsible for the transmission of information, language, again, is not even a reflection of reality. It's merely a mediation of the real. The linguistic medium is one that's constructed. Nietzsche says that what's called language is actually all figuration. And it's a figuration that's radically at odds with code, which is what video games are made of, ultimately. And there's a schizophrenic movement between natural and programming languages. The extreme redundancy of our linguistic gibberings, certainly mine tonight, at odds with the precision of bits and bytes of digital data. Computer code's the real language of interactive media. There's no I for computers. Video games are, from their institution, at odds with their own language, excreting meaningless visual outputs even, for an exhibition to which they're not even invited. They're spectacle. We are then engaged in conversation with computers and their outputs. Indeed, coding depends upon this very fact. Because computer languages are designed with the intent to sustain functionality, the very concept of closure is contrary to the purpose of code. Functionality is not supposed to be temporary, but ongoing. But, and I'll leave you on this, I'll stop talking to everyone's delight. Here's the radically decentering fact that video games can help to make apparent. Even I, as applied to ourselves, has no semantic meaning. I contains multitudes and is part of a structure of grammar that allow for communication. Now, I is a pronoun. It's essentially an empty signifier, an epiphenomenon of language, a linguistic artifact which is used to position oneself in communication. Literary theorist Kenneth Burke's provocative query actually takes on increased urgency in an age when the real is under constant reconsideration. Do we simply use words, or do they not also use us? That's it. Thanks.
Okay, so we're going to resume proceedings again. there's been a bit of a traffic jam, so our respondent isn't here. So we're just going to have a sort of open discussion, sort of Q&A. So fire any questions.
It's not a question, but it's sort of just I was listening to your stuff and I was watching the stuff with the figure and the armor. It just made me think, do you know the, I can't remember the author's name, it was so long ago I read it, but the male fantasy stuff and the free corpse, does that ring any bell to you? Okay, so it's a book about sort of the free corpse in Germany and how that sort of leads into fascism and how the male body becomes like armor. And it's almost like self is being annihilated. And just some of the things and stuff, and particularly around the core of your argument and sort of what you call your moral objection to the game, made me think, well, maybe this is where your issue's coming from. Like, and then partly is the sort of fascist annihilation of the self and the male protecting the armor at the same time. It's in order for annihilation of others and annihilation of the self.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there's certainly... And it is picking up. I can see on the thing here. But I certainly think there's something there. And I don't know how much was showing on the particular clips that I showed, but basically all the human forces that you engage in combat against as well are armored to a point where you cannot see them. Like, you can make out they're human formed, but it's a similar thing to the Alcatraz, to the look of Alcatraz. Like, they're all completely covered and you can't actually make kind of eye contact with them, if you like. It all looks roboticized in a way. And I think that's one of the ways in which many of these kind of FPSs kind of skirt responsibility for what they're doing by kind of hiding what they're doing on multiple levels. I kind of feel silly making that moral argument in a way, because like I was saying to you beforehand, like, this is not a kind of... When talking about art, like, art and morality to me, there's not necessarily a specific correlation, but I think there's something, again, like I was saying to you before, I think there's something particularly problematic about the FPSs and their kind of interactivity, if you like. The fact that you are actually doing these things. And, you know, there's some interesting statistics like school-age children in America, where studies have been done, are actually better shots, better marksmen than the majority of the police force in America, which is just terrifying on so many levels. Lucia?
So just to comment on that, from about 8 years ago, the American Air Force were recruiting more gamers than pilots.
Yeah.
Into their ranks. Because the gamers, they needed gamers for the drones.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pilots to fly their planes.
And you're even finding that with the Marine Corps now as well. The Marine Corps are spending not actually that much, but on they've specifically made a first-person shooter that's basically a recruitment tool that's available for free download. It's called America's Army. It's available for free download, and they have they spend, I think, I can't remember the figure exactly, but it's you know, something around the 20 million mark, which is just peanuts compared to the amount that they spend on advertising generally. And the figures suggest that it's about 60% of recruits of the American Army are familiar with the game. They've either played the game or they've seen someone play the game before they sign up. So it's actually working as an amazing recruitment tool, which, again, like, this is, I guess, where my moral objection comes in. Like, I'm just, yeah. Adam.
I was wondering if you had any thoughts on, do you see a distinction between first-person shooters and third-person games in the style of Red Dead Redemption, Grand Theft Auto, in terms of that interpolation through immersion and interactivity.
Yep.
And also if there's a distinction between that sandbox kind of world versus the more contained, kind of guided first-person shooter.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, on both fronts. So the question was to do with the difference between first-person and third-person games, and the follow-on was the difference between sandbox versus narrative games. To take the first part, the difference between first and third-person, absolutely, would be my answer. And to make it more than a one-word answer, I would say because third-person gives you room for that critical division that the first-person shooter just straight out doesn't. You know, some of my favorite games, well, not that I have a huge amount of time for gaming anyway, and not that I'm that interested, but certainly some of my favorite games are from the survival horror genre. The Silent Hill games, if anyone's played them, are just incredible. But also within this kind of militaristic shooter that I was talking about today, a game like Spec Ops The Line, has anyone played? It basically does what I was arguing that Peter Watt's novel does. It just completely deconstructs all of the tropes of gaming through a reproduction of them. But it can only do that because it's third person, because you can see the deterioration, both moral and physical, of the character that you are playing. As far as the differentiation between sandbox and kind of specific narrative trajectory games, I guess my answer would be kind of similar, in that with the sandbox games, it's kind of what you make of it, as opposed to these kind of, like I talked about this as like an auteur game, like the director of the game thinks of himself as a filmmaker, and it's just absolute rubbish. And it just shows, like, it's just a failure of a game, for that very reason. And that's why it's so ideologically problematic. But if you have games like Grand Theft Auto or Red Dead Redemption, Saints Row is actually a very good example of this. There is an inbuilt criticism of its very method of interacting with the player. I mean, a lot of them involve humour. It's frequently very dark humour, but it's humour nonetheless. But, yeah. To stop my rant, the essential point was that I think my answer's the same. It's that critical boundary that's just shattered in a first-person shooter. That's the difference. Yeah.
Just to respond to your point about the director and positioning himself as an auteur, are there other games that... I mean, I know many games have those elaborate trailers, and that was an incredibly filmic trailer.
Yeah.
To me, particularly the choice of music and, you know,
just... Oh, did anyone pick up on the...
Who was it?
Yeah. Oh, right, yeah.
Composer, yeah.
Yeah.
Was it a sci-fi composer?
No. Oh, maybe. No one? Hans Zimmer.
Oh.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. Like, that is... I mean, there was a lot of money that went into this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, sorry.
Look, whether he's an auteur or not is kind of irrelevant, but if he's... The fact that he's positioning himself as such and the way that the game is positioning itself in that trailer and through using those really filmic tropes and genre and music. Have you read a lot of that stuff on cinematic narratives in video games and the way, because you sort of touched on it, but I just wanted your thoughts on, you know, other games that try to be cinematic in the ways that they went. Is this unique?
So the question is about the uniqueness of Crysis and whether there are other cinematic games.
I mean, I know that there are because I'm sure I've been writing, but yeah.
Yeah, maybe you can direct me in the direction of some of this said writing. I haven't read anything on this specifically.
Okay.
However, my thoughts on it are, yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of games that are incredibly cinematic. This is just incredibly ham-fisted, which is why I'm so against it. But I earlier mentioned things like the Silent Hill series. Incredibly cinematic, but incredibly cleverly done. There's also a number of games that are just... There are actually an increasing number of games that are seen as kind of auteur games. So the game producer becomes in their own field a kind of household name. So you have Will Wright, who did The Sims, for instance. You have quite a few figures, but usually they're known for doing something kind of out of the box.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with this title, Yearly has ambitions to be an auteur, but makes a really shitty game.
Yeah.
Like, and that's probably the uniqueness of this title in particular. Like, a lot of games have this cinematic aspiration,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of them fall flat. But the ones that do fall flat aren't kind of celebrated by their creator as I'm reinventing the wheel. Like,
yeah. And are there game producers who consistently sort of make, you know, in a similar way to an auteur, make like sort of consistent body of work that all references similar themes, or are they just like The Sims guy? Has he made other similar stuff?
Yeah, so Will Wright did SimCity. So it's basically all simulation stuff that he's known for. The one that's leaping immediately to mind is David Gage, he actually calls them like interactive narrative as opposed to video games. And essentially it's just a whole bunch of, essentially it's just a very, very long movie in which you have to press buttons to make the action proceed. They're incredibly boring.
I was gonna say.
Incredibly boring. But yeah, there are certain auteurs that you can play a game, however you want to define that, by them and go, okay, this is such and such's game. The weird thing is many of the more unique games, certainly in the kind of AAA or the mainstream kind of Hollywood version, commercial market, are just terrible. I don't know why they keep selling so much, but that's life. Yeah.
I have another question for you. Regarding the, if you strip away the interactivity element of it, and I'm thinking of something like moving out of games but into cinema, like Hardcore Henry,
as
a first person cinematic experience that is replicating a lot of the tropes of gaming, but taking away that interactivity. I'm wondering your thoughts on the kind of the first person, second person distinction in that sort of, and whether or not you feel that. In cinematic mode, does that carry over in some way?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. The question was about first person in cinema, particularly referencing Hardcore Henry as reproducing some of gaming's tropes. I think Hardcore Henry, again, I feel like a broken record here in a sense, but that Hardcore Henry is kind of deliberately funny and self-critical of the very things that it's reproducing. I mean, like that end shot of him strangling someone with his own eyeball, for example. Like, it's just like, what the fuck am I watching? But it's kind of hilarious in a really bleak way. I do feel there are... In a way, I kind of feel like... I mean, Lady in the Lake is my go-to thing with first person in cinema, right? Dismal failure. And I think perhaps the only way that these things can work, as in the case of Hardcore Henry, arguably, is if they have a sense of humour about them, if they're kind of self-critical. As soon as they try and take themselves seriously as, you know, art with a capital A, they're doomed to failure because they're just not very good. But if they can embrace their campness, I think that's kind of a different story. And again, this is what Crisis does not do, in a way that I've been talking about other games that aren't first person, but like something like Bioshock, if anyone's played Bioshock, incredibly, like, it's a first person exactly like this. The camera view is the same. It's from, you know, all you see of the corporeal elements is the gun and the hands and stuff, but it's also playing with its own tropes while it's reproducing them, and therefore it's a lot more it's perhaps a lot more distancing as well, but it's certainly self-critical. Did anyone notice my sleight of hand there in talking about just throughout the entire paper as far as talking about the interactivity of games and the kind of things that I was showing? None of them were interactive, right? Like, these are all film clips.
Oh, yeah.
These are all promotional clips.
That's actually the question I was going to ask.
Oh, sorry, Luke.
Sort of, no story about that, but it was this...
I thought the first one you showed, though, was... I thought it was...
Yeah, the one I was talking over was game footage, yeah.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if you could tease out a bit more, was that sort of that spectacle narrative, first person playing directly, but particularly the spectacle narrative element of your talk, because also at that one point you said, sort of like when it becomes cinematic, when we have that sort of, you know, those sort of, cut sequences where we see it like it was a film and then we go back to it, first person interactivity. And then later on you mentioned pornography, and that made me think, oh, okay, pornography, well that's Linda Williams, and talking about how the porn sequences used to be inserted within narrative films as the 70s porn, when you still went to the cinema and there's a whole narrative of porn sequences inserted in.
Clearly I was born in the wrong age.
And that made me think of that, and Linda Williams does allusions to pornography and the musical. So the musical sequence, pornography sequence, is being like the musical sequence that becomes asserted within.
Yeah.
Entering into that, and I just because it was almost like you were playing with these things without making those connections.
Specific connections.
And I was just wondering if that was something.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's. Spectacle is another one of those words that's kind of used, it's thrown around like we know what it is, but at the same time there's so little theorization about how it differs from narrative. And I mean, I read a really interesting article on The Matrix, of all things, that was talking about the use of spectacle to create narrative or to propel narrative, as opposed to things like the other things that I'd read before that are like, as soon as the spectacle of the, you know, action sequence in an action film starts, as soon as the spectacle of the musical number in a musical starts, the narrative stops. And this particular article, I'd have to pull up who it was that wrote it, but he was arguing that there is no division. There is no division whatsoever. If there is no spectacle, then there is no narrative, which I don't think at all addresses your question, but it was something that in my inebriated state I was like, I can say something about that. But sorry, what was the actual question?
It was between narrative and spectacle, and I thought about those links between narrative and spectacle and photography, because you do have music in that as well.
Yeah. Look, I hope so, would be my answer to that. I just haven't done the legwork to be able to say yay or nay. But certainly I think there would be ways in which to talk about, you know, bringing in all these notions of spectacle and narrative into a kind of tight little bow, I think. Hey, Ari.
How are you?
Welcome. Thanks, mate.
Very much enjoyed. You can listen to the podcast.
Hear yourself. In a kind of weird third person, first person liminal space. I've scared everyone into submission, Ari, so it might be over to you.
It's up to you.
Okay.
Thanks for coming.
So I guess, not having heard the other questions that people kind of raised, it means that some of this might be repetitive, but I suppose what I really liked about the paper as a reader was one thing. It seemed to me that you're actually grappling with serious questions vis-a-vis the ontology of representation in a non-superficial fashion, in a kind of age of off-the-rack academic solutions, in inverted commas. It's nice to kind of actually read a document that is trying to map, trying to think through, and trying to kind of process thought. It sounds silly, but like so many kind of academic papers are just basically paint by the numbers kinds of things, where people take a paradigm and then just insert the...
Consume, conform, repeat, I think,
yeah,
is
exactly
what I'd describe them as. But yeah, thank you. That's
and
nice
it seemed
to
like,
say.
Like to this, there's a kind of freedom evident here in terms of your willingness to try to set your own questions, which reminded me of Deleuze's point in Bergsonism about genuine freedom only lying in the setting of the questions as opposed to the trying to process the answers.
Yeah,
and so there's a lot of stuff in here that I found really provocative.
Good.
And then that comparison between the game and the novel,
that
was really kind of rich too. I thought just the idea of the novelization of the sequel to the game.
Yeah.
It's kind of great. What a great thing to look at. The novelization of the game. What does that even mean?
Yeah.
And I guess that's one of the things you're trying to kind of navigate.
Yeah.
The kind of questions that I'd raise, that it sounded like you were just discussing one of them when I came in, which was about the relationship between spectacle and narrative, I guess, was that?
Yeah.
Which was a kind of question I had, which was, it seems at times a bit overly dependent on some kind of division between spectacle and exposition.
Sure.
Which, I don't know how pertinent it is to a discussion of in a contemporary kind of digital media world. And I maybe think of the Kristen Whistle Spectacular Digital Effects.
I haven't come across
Kristen
it.
Whistle, which is looking at trying to kind of destabilize or problematize the notion that spectacle is a thing that's separate from exposition in the first place.
Yeah.
And I guess one kind of point or one book or work that might be interesting for you to look at is, which you might have looked at, but it's not in the bibliography or in the paper, is Bernard Stiegler's Techniques and Time.
I haven't come across it, no.
Techniques and Time, because that I'm just reading at the moment, that offers a really kind of beautiful discussion of technological determinism as a kind of genetic trait of technology and as shaping, you know, objects that appear within that. Also, the opening, you're setting up what you said, consume, conform, repeat. Nice kind of little soundbite. Which is interesting,
yeah.
That relationship between narrative, capitalism, and media, and repetition.
Right.
What is repetition? Because it seems like repetition is a dominant kind of thing that you're talking about. And,
sure.
You know, it's integral to capitalism in terms of concepts like innovation, how that fits into it, but also media, and also kind of genre and narrative. So,
right.
Including what it means to kind of die and be reborn.
Yeah.
In a game.
Yeah.
Because that also is really kind of interesting.
Yeah.
What does it mean to kind of consume a mass-produced form of death?
Right.
In that sense.
Yeah.
And I guess media as relating to this relationship between capitalism and repetition and narrative, I think, is also... There seems to be a kind of liberal presumption underpinning the paper that violence is bad.
Yeah.
Why is violence bad?
Mm.
In what context is violence bad?
Mm.
Is it always bad? What kind of violence? For example, there's a quote on page 2 where you say that first-person shooters are ideologically suspect.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like you were just talking about that because you're implying that just violence is bad.
Yeah.
Maybe
sure.
It is, but you need to kind of explain what you think about that. And I think violence generally is kind of under-theorized here.
Okay.
Given you're talking about, you know, playing off a kind of sense of the barbarism of you know, massacres and that kind of stuff.
I do absolutely take your point on the under-theorization of violence, particularly. And my kind of my essential underlining assumption, I am surprised at the profound moralism that this moralistic position I've taken in this paper. I don't know where it's come from.
Of course, you're a bourgeois moralist.
Clearly it is. But I think it's something to do with... And this is something I do address in other places in the thesis, but I think that one of the things that you know, I just kind of threw away in question time before you got here was, you know, the research that's done that says that American school-aged children are better marksmen than American police. To you know, like a 90% accuracy rate. And I think that's where the moral kind of impetus of this entire thing is born from. But yes, I absolutely do have to work through why it is that I consider, you know, fake violence to be a bad thing.
Well, of course, it's weaponizing the eye.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I mean, I also take your point that you make in a couple of articles of yours that I read about the action film, that you know, violence in and of itself, even if it isn't kind of self-aware, can still be kind of critical of itself in a way. Like, I'm thinking about your Cobra paper in particular. Like, it's it gave me a lot to think about, and I just wasn't quite sure how to process that in this kind of top-down moralistic FPS is a bad thing that this paper ended up being. And it's certainly something that I'm going to have to think through a lot more. Thank you, everyone, for coming.
Thank you for listening to the Sydney Screen Studies Network Talks. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. You can follow us on Twitter @_SSSnetwork, like us on Facebook @Sydney Screen Studies, and visit us at sydneyscreenstudies.wordpress.com.